You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, speaking to you from the winter wonderland that is the Seattle area today. We have experienced the glory of a snowstorm. Unlike the rest of the country, you know, the rest of the country has their first snowstorm in like November or depending on where you are, perhaps October even. But Washington gets snow like every 5 years, maybe. We'll get some kind of snow. We've had 12 white Christmases in the past 100 years.
That's saying something.
You may have noticed my Monday co-host, Sherry Antonetti, the lively, the glamorous, the fetching, yes, all of those things. Fetching is a term that you just don't hear that often, and I think that it's great. So I
like that. That works for me. I'm always fetching shoes and socks and.
Unfortunately, but at any rate, out where Sherry lives, out there on the East Coast, those poor souls get buried in snow.
Oh, but today it's 57, and my kids are outside biking. Spring. It's awesome.
That's the difference between us, because here in Washington, it is a glittering winter wonderland. We had a lovely winter storm come blowing in last night.
And well, see, I would like some snow, but I have guaranteed for the duration of this year that there shall be no snow, because I bought my husband for Christmas a snowblower. So
that ensures it.
It's done.
Yeah, that, it really does. You know, it's like, and if you want to make it even worse, get him like a jet ski thing, one of those snow things. And
yeah, we bought our kids sleds. Yeah, that was fun.
That's just not going to happen. But here we had snow. And so we got we got 3 inches of snow, which is an unthinkable amount of snow for Seattle as a regular thing.
So the world stopped?
Seattle just closes. Yeah. Yes. 3 inches of snow. I mean, 3 inches of snow in Maryland is like, that's, you just lace up your boots and you get going.
Because there's hills. So see, they kind of get antsy when you get over 2 inches. They do honestly get a little...
I think everybody on the East Coast is just totally ready to cope.
No, Maryland in particular is very skittish about snow. The running gag used to be there's been a warning of a flake. Abandon your cars now.
I did not know that. I just assumed everybody on the East Coast knows how to handle snow. Seattleites are like helpless in the snow. They just they just curl up in a fetal position, and there's no. So this morning. My son works for the Seattle School District, so he got up and, first thing he did was call in. And, of course, the entire Seattle School District, in fact, all of Western Washington is just closed for the day.
That's kind of awesome.
2 inches of snow, because Seattle's just got no preparation for it. It's, if snow were a virus, then we are the most immunocompromised area in all of continental U.S. We just have no capacity for coping with it at all.
Well, I think the proper way to cope with snow is to stop everything, brew some hot chocolate, and enjoy it. Exactly. So I think that's the correct response.
Yes, totally. I completely agree. So I'm and of course the problem is, I'm self-employed, so it's not like I have to go anywhere. I commute from my bed to my computer.
Yes.
And since my foot is currently touching my bed as I sit at my computer, that tells you how far the commute is. So, I got up and I looked out there and I thought, oh, it's so glorious. So what I did was with my son came in and said, Dad, want to go for a walk in the snow? I said, absolutely.
Right.
So we put on our shoes and we went out in the snow and we walked, and it snowed harder and harder while we were taking a walk. It was absolutely splendid. And then we stopped at the library, and I thought, this seems like a good day for having some Star Wars movies.
Yes.
Because, you know, snow and stuff. So we grabbed a couple of movies. And then on the way back, there's this forest. Because that's the nice thing about living where I live. I live in this kind of bedroom community north of Seattle. Mm-hmm. And there are regular, like, real forests that you could just walk into. You just step off the road and you're in a forest. And if you didn't know it, you would never know that you were in a large suburban area, because you really are just in the, all of a sudden you're surrounded by trees and there's no civilization in sight. It's a great feeling.
That's awesome.
All snowy with the big, you know, we live out here with the big evergreen trees, lots of spruces and Doug firs and hemlocks and cedars and everything. And so it was just this magnificent snowy scene. And my son and I, we both just couldn't, we just started laughing because it was so beautiful.
And, that sounds awesome.
So yeah, it was a fantastic way to spend, you know, an hour.
As a result, you could say that the commute this morning to work was a bear. You know, I just couldn't get there. I had to, you had to go the long way.
Well, the problem, you know, both the good and the bad, of course, is that my boss is like really understanding. When you're self-employed, your boss is always understanding.
That's true.
But the thing is the boss is like always there, too, saying, shouldn't you get back to work? You should really get back to work. You got stuff to do, don't you? I mean, I understand that you're walking in the woods, but at the same time, think about your responsibility. So he could be kind of a nag that way.
I think you can handle him.
I think I can handle him. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, sometimes, I mean, if I feel like going to, like, a movie instead of working, he's fine with that, you know. He always loves me.
No, it's easy to schmooze the boss, you know.
Hey. Yeah.
Yep. I got tickets to the movie. Want to go?
Well, the thing is he's married to my wife, and so I know him really, really well. And so I figured today we could. You had written me about something, and I was noticing this as well.
Okay.
And I thought it would be worth discussing this a little bit. So one of the things that is getting to be a popular meme. I've seen variations on this in the past.
Yes.
And the latest iteration came from, I saw a tweet, and I've seen other people doing similar things say, you know, so there's a tweet that said, hey, Starbucks, instead of hiring 10,000 refugees, how about hiring 10,000 veterans?
So what about that? You can hear the sneer. You know?
And I've seen this stuff before, and it always, you know, the assumption, of course, is that Starbucks just, you know, a veteran walks into Starbucks and asks for a job, and Starbucks just throws hot coffee in his face.
Yes, those cruel Starbucks leftists, they just don't care about veterans.
And it's like...
it's nuts on you.
And this... you know, the whole dynamic behind this, of course, is to pit the plight of homeless refugees. We got our homeless veterans. We got homeless veterans right here in Seattle.
Yes, and in D.C.
Sure, yes. Sure. And all over the place. And the fact that there is one veteran homeless anywhere in the United States is an absolute scandal.
It is a crime, because they've given everything for their country and they ought to be taken care of by their country. That should be the very least that we do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, there should not be any homeless veteran anywhere in the United States. It should not happen. And so I have...
Go ahead.
My disgust with a system that has treated our veterans this way just knows no bounds. And so it's really easy with a tweet like this to get people going, yes, veterans, you know, because we really have treated our veterans just in an incredible way. disgusting amount of contempt. Oh, that poor little one.
Yeah, she's getting to pick the television show. Hang on for a second. I'll be right back. The
criminality of it all. So when we hear this disgusting treatment of our veterans, of course, it's natural to take their side, and we should. But what we shouldn't do and mustn't do and can't do is get played by apologists for the Trump administration who cynically pit veterans against refugees as though the refugees are the problem. As though refugees are somehow scheming to take jobs away from veterans. And if it wasn't for those damned refugees, we'd be able to take care of our veterans. But because the refugees are screwing
it's
our veterans.
Silly. It's silly. Well, I mean, I've seen a similar kind of nonsense thinking about, you know, if you can't be, you know, don't protest about the unborn children unless you're guaranteeing that you're taking care of every single person that's out there who's been abused. And it's not that, and it's pitting the woman who's been abused against the unborn. No, right. We need to take care of both.
Right, exactly. Or vice versa. I mean, I hear it from the other end, you know. Why do you care about X, Y, and Z, you know, who's suffering an assault to their dignity as long as there's abortion going on anywhere in the world?
Well, like saying Mother Teresa doesn't do enough because there are more still people who are hungry and dying.
Yeah. And so this whole, and it's incredibly cynical.
Yes.
This attempt to pit one group of persons against one group of victims against another group of victims and then, you know, try to make one or the other into the villain of the piece. We'll talk about who benefits from that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. Sherry was remarking to me the other day on Facebook something that I noticed too, which is the current dumb thing about pitting refugees against homeless veterans. So somebody was Starbucks had said that they were going to be giving 10,000 jobs to refugees, and that's like, okay. Good.
Good on them.
Refugees need jobs, you know. And instead of saying good, people are giving work to refugees. Instead, you get this thing about, you know, well, why don't you give work to homeless veterans instead? Starbucks immediately replied, "We do actually have a jobs program for homeless veterans." And it's like, so
mic drop. Fail.
But it tells you something, because the question was asked in complete insincerity. The goal was not really there was no real interest in homeless veterans. All the real goal, the rhetorical goal of that remark was, of course, to defend Trump's assault on refugees, that refugees are our enemies. And they're taking something away from veterans, that we don't have enough room for them. And as long as we're helping them, it's a zero-sum game. We're not helping veterans. And this notion of the zero-sum game, that whatever good is being done for one person is something that's being done to hurt another person, is a very old game in American social and political life. It goes back a couple of centuries. What you had, particularly when Irish immigrants began to get here, and when immigrants began to come to the United States, there was a danger that that the upper class faced in this country. And the danger was you might wind up with an alliance between lower classes like the Irish slave class. The black slave class in the United States might look at each other and say, you know what? We're both getting jerked around here a lot.
Maybe if we united, we could do something about this,
you know? So what the upper class very cleverly did was they began to tell the Irish lower classes and other lower classes in this country, you better watch out. Because if those blacks get, you know, loose, they're going to take your jobs. They're the problem. And the lower classes said, yeah, man, you're right. And so as long as they could look down on somebody, they were happy. Because at least I'm not as low as that guy over there, that black guy over there. And that trick has been played repeatedly in our public life. So a couple of years ago, when people were, you've got the problem of people who are working two, sometimes three jobs, sometimes husband and wife both working multiple jobs, making crap wages, working for, you know, McDonald's or whatever restaurant, right? Just trying to keep body and soul together. Right. And so they asked for something that, in fact, Catholic teaching says was perfectly legitimate for them to ask for, which is to say, a living wage. You should be able, says the church, to be able to have enough to live on, to support a family, and even have a little leisure time on the job that you're doing. And if you're not making enough to live on, then your employer is
exploiting
wronging you. Is it exploiting you? And so you get places like Walmart that actually tell their employees, you know, we're not going to pay you, but here's how you can go on welfare so that we don't have to pay you. And you know, and so so there was a push a couple of years ago for a raise in the minimum wage.
Yeah, didn't that happen in Seattle and in the Washington State?
Yeah, it's happened in Washington State. It seems to be doing, you know, as it always turns out to do, it seems to be working well because, of course, when you've got people with more money, they have more disposable cash and they buy stuff. Who'd have thought? So, but the memes that came out that flooded the internet at this time, what you saw repeatedly were this. You saw a meme that would say, you know, here's a soldier in harm's way, making some crappy wage of, you know, $8 an hour. And here's a cop in harm's way, and he's making some lousy wage. And here's an EMT making a lousy wage. Oh, and look at this guy that works for McDonald's just flipping burgers, and he wants $15 an hour. Outrageous. So everybody looks at this beep, and they get mad because the uppity McDonald's worker wants more money than this brave soldier, this daring cop, this compassionate EMT. That I hate that McDonald's worker so much. Well, who profits from that? Not the soldier, not the cop,
not the EMT.
The guys that profit from that are the ones who underpay soldiers, cops, EMTs, and McDonald's workers.
Right.
And that's how it always works.
And the result is that nobody gets helped.
Right. Nobody gets helped. Well, except, of course, the guy, the CEO for McDonald's, who makes a gazillion dollars because he underpays.
Let me rephrase that. Nobody who really needs help.
Nobody needs help gets help. Yeah, right. Exactly. And this strategy of getting people to look at whoever is even less fortunate than they are and say, well, at least I'm not a loser like that scum.
Yeah.
That works over and over. There's something in human psychology that seems to respond to that. And the result, of course, is that we're constantly getting suckered.
I ain't a good person, but I ain't the worst in the world either, kind of.
Well, yeah, and it's not even a question of whether or not you're a good person or not. It's just I'm not getting screwed like that guy's getting screwed.
So therefore, I'm better off. So yay me.
And one of the things that the church calls us to, the church calls us to solidarity, calls us to remember that we are with the least of these, and to take the part of the least of these. And if we do that, one of the side benefits of, first of all, being charitable to the least of these and beginning to take the part of the least of these is you start thinking, you know what, if we actually teamed up, we might get something accomplished for both of us, you know, terms of
might
not
be
getting
better.
Screwed out of our just wages. And we're not talking about, you know, a class revolution. This is not Marxism. This is just Catholic teaching. This is just, you know, the church saying, look, there's nothing wrong with a just wage, with a living wage. We're not talking about, equal pay for everybody about everything, because, of course,
that's not just either, because
just wage, it depends on, you know, there's all kinds of things that depends on where do you live and what's the cost of living and et cetera, et cetera.
And what you're doing. I mean, if you're a heart surgeon, you know, if he says I need this much in order to take your child's heart out of his chest, pack it in ice, fix it, and then put it back in, and then your child will be alive and running 8 years from now, I'm going to say, what do you need?
Right.
Because that sounds like magic voodoo to me. Oh my gosh. Just even saying that sentence freaks me out. So thank you for saying that you can do this. I'm amazed.
Yeah. And so it's, when we're looking at the church's teaching, that's the first thing that we have to do is really pay attention to what the church is saying here and not have Pavlovian responses. You know, what? Living wage? That sounds socialist. I reject socialism. Well,
you want me to be reflective about church teachings?
I know. Having to stop.
It's so hard.
But it's like, you know, just stop, pause, listen to what the church has to say. Don't just reflexively respond. And when you do, what you constantly find is the church is teaching, so much of it is just common sense. It's all coming out of Scripture. And it makes things better if we'll just listen, you know.
We also always go deeper and deeper in. I mean, this sweet, but you know, you don't give the least. That's not the goal, to give the least amount possible.
Right.
The goal is to love. And you can't love if you're sitting here going, well, zero-sum games is not love. Zero-sum games is miserly giving, so to speak.
Right. Well, and simply, you know, kind of stopping and listening to, you know, so when somebody says, look, it's refugees or homeless vets, choose. You know, the first thing you could do is go, is that even true? I mean, that the moment you say it out loud, you go, that's ridiculous. So who's benefiting here, really? And very important question to ask. We will be back here on Connecting the Dots right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. My co-host today is Sherry Antonetti. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. And you just ran across over the break a really interesting quote from the perpetually insightful G.K. Chesterton. Chesterton just, he's got both eyes open. One of my favorite dedications from one author to another is Neil Gaiman, who's just a terrific writer of fantasy and horror. He wrote a series, a kind of a graphic novel series called Sandman.
Ooh.
A few years back. And one of them was dedicated to G.K. Chesterton.
I have to go get this now.
And but he, what I love about Gaiman, Gaiman's a really interesting bird. He's somebody who has a real high degree of regard for Chesterton, Tolkien, Lewis. He himself was raised in a Scientology household, if you can believe this. He's an Englishman, lives in the U.S. now, married to a musician named Amanda Palmer. Gaiman's written a bunch of interesting things. If you saw the film Coraline a couple of years ago.
Yes, I did.
That was a Neil Gaiman story.
Oh my goodness.
Just an interesting guy. Big fan of H.P. Lovecraft as well. And he dedicated one of his books to Chesterton. And his dedication was to G.K. Chesterton, who knew what was going on.
Yes, and that's a good description of him.
And that is a great description of Chesterton, because Chesterton was just somebody who somehow or other retained the faculty of prudence and just could see with both eyes and didn't BS himself and didn't BS the rest of us. And consequently, he sees these things that the rest of us don't see, but the moment he articulates it, you go,
duh, that was obvious. That, oh my gosh.
True. And why have I never seen that? And the moment he says it, though, you go, that is so true. And so, case in point, this reading that you just found.
Yes.
Because this is profound. Go ahead.
But this is from Uncertain Modern Writers and the Institution of the Family, Heretics of 1905, just if anyone's curious. But the man who lives in a small community lives in a much larger world. He knows much more of the fierce varieties and uncompromising divergencies of men. The reason is obvious. In a large community, we can choose our companions. In a small community, our companions are chosen for us. Thus, in all extensive and highly civilized societies, groups come into existence founded upon what is called sympathy and shut out the real world more sharply than the gates of a monastery. There is nothing really narrow about the clan. The thing which is really narrow is the clique. The men of the clan live together because they all wear the same tartan or are all descended from the same sacred cow. But in their souls, by the divine luck of things, there will always be more colors than in any tartan. But in the men of the clique, who live together because they had the same kind of soul. And their narrowness is a narrowness of spiritual coherence and contentment, like that which exists in hell.
Wow.
He goes on, but I mean, I was highlighting, and then I stopped highlighting because I was going to outline the whole darn thing.
Yeah. But, you know, it really is true, and it's an amazing anticipation of the sociology of the internet.
Yes.
And which unfortunately is increasingly the sociology of America, and has given us, I think, a lot of what we're seeing now, because what Chesterton got and really appreciated was that you can pick your friends, but you're stuck with your family.
Yes.
And so, by the way, just so you understand, modern American listener, when Chesterton speaks of the Klan, he doesn't mean the Ku Klux Klan. He's an Englishman.
He means your family, your
kin. He means your family group, your right.
Kin.
Right.
You know, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins, your second cousins, the people that you have to see at Christmas and Easter and at other events.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what he appreciates about the family, and especially about the large family, and he experienced this in his own life, was that the family throws you together with people that you would never otherwise socialize with.
Yes, it does.
And so he had a brother, he said, his brother, you know, he spent his entire life arguing with his brother. And he loved his brother, but at the same time disagreed with his brother on so much stuff. And so he learned through that experience to argue with somebody that he loved. And this very much affected the way he argued the rest of his life, because he argued with everybody all the time about everything. And so when you read Chesterton, that's so much of what he's doing, is he's arguing with people and arguing with people that he has real disagreements with. That whole book that you're quoting from, Heretics,
yes,
was nothing but a bunch of different arguments with every leading light of his age, and he knew them all.
Yes, that's what's amazing, is he had his hand everywhere. I'm going to talk about everything.
Right. So, you know, the names that people might recognize today that he argues with are people like George Bernard Shaw.
Right.
And H.G. Wells, you know, he was a mm-hmm. friend of H.G. Wells. But there are lots of other people that he argues with. And the way he puts things is often so beautiful, you know. So he remarked of Bernard Shaw, for example, that he said he could know he was under the cruel stricture of being the sort of man who could only tell a lie when he thought it was the truth. which I thought was just very gracious of him, you know. So he really does argue with people like Shaw and Wells and say, no, you're wrong, and this is going to lead to catastrophe. But he always respects the fact that as wrong as they are sincere. They're trying to do the right thing, even though they're fantastically wrong about a whole lot of different things. And that quote that you just read, I just think is so profound, because it really does describe the internet. The internet is, you know, you can go on the internet, you can go anywhere in the world that you like.
Yes.
And talk to anybody that you like. And the vast majority of people go straight for a little self-constructed bubble of like-minded people who will tell them what they already think.
Yes. Yes. It goes on from there. It even hits it even harder. A big society is a society for the promotion of narrowness. It is a machinery for the purpose of guarding the solitary and sensitive individual from all experiences of the bitter and bracing human compromises.
Yes. Yeah. He says, go ahead.
It is, in the most literal sense of the words, a society for the prevention of Christian knowledge.
So he remarks elsewhere, he says, you know, the amazing thing about about owning a home, he says, in your home, you can, if you like, have a picnic in the middle of the living room, and nobody's going to stop you. You can do whatever you like at home, but when you step out the door, you step into this rank of people who are all marching in line off to work, you know, and everybody has to be exactly the same. And so the idea that it's when you step out of your home that you're becoming uniform and losing your individuality. And he was absolutely dead set against the notion that, you know, your family was this stultifying influence that crushed your individuality, and it was only by escaping the home you could become who you truly are. You know, he said, when you leave the home, that's when you put on the mask and you become anonymous and you have to wear a tie.
Yeah, you wear a uniform,
and there's nothing, you know, and so when you go to work, that's where you have to mind your P's and Q's, and, you know, there are certain things that must not be thought, must not be said, or you're going to lose your job.
Right.
Something I have some experience with. because, you know, it's equally true that spirit, tragically, you know, is beginning now to pervade the American Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church is supposed to be, and still, thank God, is in many ways, you know, the home of eccentrics and people with bizarre ideas that
It's supposed to be messy.
And yet, you know, even there, you can certainly find, and I've experienced it myself. You can find people who will say there are things that must not be thought, things that must not be said. And if
we don't
you say
do it that way, or it's wrong,
we'll
if you do it that
punish
way.
You. Now, no. The nice thing, of course, is that it's not everywhere like that in the Catholic Church. and so, you know, because the Catholic Church is so huge, you can escape one subculture and find another one where somebody's not gonna, you know, press you into conformity. But that thing that Chesterton is seeing is real, and it's something that has accelerated weirdly due to the internet, because the internet has become it's the place where thousands of little tiny sociological bubbles can be created.
Hives.
And you need never ever leave that bubble and encounter anybody who will say anything that makes you uncomfortable ever again. And that's a real loss, because we should be encountering those people all the time. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti. And we will be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connected the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Sherry Antonetti. And we, you know, one of the things, of course, that happened this past weekend was the Super Bowl, where America's most beloved team,
the Patriots,
the New England Patriots, pulled it out and managed the miraculous. People were so happy about
or
that.
Some were.
The vast majority of America just overwhelmed. Well, who was it? Somebody said. Oh, that was it. Patrick Madrid posted a picture of the quarterback of the Atlanta Falcons with Hillary Clinton's head photoshopped.
It did feel like that. Every pundit had, yeah.
But then Frank Beckwith said yes, but the Falcons won the popular vote.
There you go. Well,
I must confess, I missed the whole thing. There was a birthday party for somebody, and it was like, this isn't the Seahawks, so why should I care?
Well, the first three quarters, I'm sitting there thinking, did everybody get fake news about how bad the Patriots were going to do? I mean, about how good the Patriots were, because they were not there for three quarters of the game. And so it did feel sort of like the election for the first three quarters.
Yeah, you did. You know, you wanted to see a halftime show where it would just have a big picture of Truman holding up Dewey.
Yes. I think Lady Gaga was going to do that, but then decided against it because it'd be too controversial and she didn't want to be political.
Yeah, she didn't want to be controversial. Well, you know, that's the other thing. So having missed the whole thing, I come onto Facebook this morning and everything is about, weirdly, it wasn't even about the Patriots winning, which I think is probably just people blocking and in denial. But instead, it was all it was like sublimation. We can't talk about this because we're all in denial. So instead, everything was about Lady Gaga's halftime thing, which I also completely missed because I totally missed the game. And it was all like, was this, you know, the greatest patriotic salute of all time? Or was it a satanic ritual dedicating the United States to the devil? And I was like, I'm losing consciousness. The lack of caring that I have right now is somewhere around 10 or 15 on the Richter scale, and I'm just not caring at all. So I still haven't seen it. No idea. The only thing I know about this is that The Simpsons foretold it 5 years ago, which that's good enough for me. I love that The Simpsons foretold Lady Gaga's like trampoline act or whatever it was. No, it was on like a high bar act or
she was on a high wire. She was on a wire and she jumped down from the top of the roof and came down onto a stage. Now, who knows if she didn't watch that. That's worth seeing. It was amazing. Well, yeah,
you do wonder, did she watch The Simpsons and get her idea from that? Or was this something that she arrived at on her own?
I am, by the way, convinced that Matt Groening has a Palantir because he predicted President Trump and Lady Gaga's performance.
It's starting to get creepy, you know?
I'm going to ask him for stock picks.
One of the things that most pleases me about Matt Groening, and it periodically pops up in his cartoons. So like a Futurama episode at one point, somebody comes running up, they're looking for a job and they're waving around their diploma and it's only there for like just a flash. But if you stop the video and look, the diploma is from the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, where Matt Groening went. At the Evergreen State College. So periodically he will get a dig in at Evergreen State College, which makes me super happy. I've been to their campus one time, and it's kind of the original flaky liberal arts school. So I find that hilarious. But if they do nothing else besides give us Matt Groening, they have completely paid for their use of real estate. So I got distracted. You were gonna. There was something you wanted to talk about.
Well, it was about Bishop Barron.
Yes.
Going to talk, give an interview.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
He gave a lengthy hour-long interview with. You're gonna have to give me the name again of the gentleman.
A guy named Dave Rubens. So he is a. Atheist, marijuana rights, gay guy who recently got married.
Yeah.
And he's got like this webcast called The Rubin Report. And the thing about the guy is that he's also a free speech advocate, as you would expect.
And he does very good interviews, period. He tries to give the guests the opportunity to speak their piece. He may disagree with it, but he's not there playing gotcha. He actually is asking questions and inquiring, please give me your position. Tell me what you think.
Exactly. And so he contacted Bishop Barron. I guess he lives in L.A. too or something. I'm not sure. Somehow or other, he ran across Bishop Barron's work. And because Bishop Barron also has like a YouTube channel and all of this stuff, and invited him to be on the show. And Bishop Barron is the kind of guy who's like, fantastic, you know, absolutely, because he is all about, like our Pope, he's all about evangelization. Mm-hmm. And so, man, you know, a chance to go and address a guy with a colossal, huge audience full of atheists. Mm-hmm. Okay, where do I, when do I?
Yeah, I'm in. Deal me in.
And so he did, and you should go and see it if you're out there in Radio Land and you have not seen it. Go online, just Google Bishop Barron and Rubin Report. You'll go right to it, and watch this interview because
it's extraordinary,
it's amazing interview. Yeah, it was very thoughtfully done. Rubin is a very respectful interview. He's not there to just play gotcha games and all this stuff. And they had a fantastic conversation, very respectful, very intelligent conversation.
And he asked hard questions and he gave good answers, immediate answers. This was not a case of, I'm going to throw you softballs because you're my guest. This was, what about when, you know, what is the concept of God? What do you mean by, you know, are you against gay marriage? What do you think should be done about the sexual abuse? And I mean, he did not, it was not a soft interview, but but it wasn't a, I'm here to get you.
Right. And he was not looking for ammo, you know, and just trying to figure out a way to destroy Bishop Barron or anything like that.
And to bring it back to what we were talking about earlier, this is a case of where, you know, the bishop went and spoke to someone with whom he has an actual disagreement, just like Chesterton would go and have conversations with people with whom he had an actual disagreement.
Yeah.
And give his perspective.
Yeah.
And it's the way it's evangelization done right, in that he didn't go there to convert Reuben. He went there to talk to Reuben and to answer Reuben's questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sparked a lot of interest on the part of a lot of people who watched it, who have never heard what Catholic teaching actually is. They've only heard what Catholic teaching says you should not do.
Right. And the great thing about it, and one of the great ironies about it, and it's the same thing that our Pope is constantly run into, is the feedback from Reuben's audience, which, you know, lots of atheists, the feedback was incredibly positive. The response over and over was, I'm an atheist, but I could listen to this guy all day long. This was fantastic. You know, this actually brought my respect for the Catholic Church up, and I didn't think that was possible, and et cetera, right?
Yes.
And the only people who were angry and upset about this were people like LifeSite News, you know? And I mean, the people who are the best Catholics in the world, in their own estimation, they were furious about this interview. Just like they've been furious at the Pope, and for the same reason. He dines with tax collectors and sinners.
Yes.
Why is he talking to those people and not to good Catholics like us?
If you knew what this woman was like, you wouldn't let her touch you.
You wouldn't let her touch you. And it's like, you know, and in the words of Yoda, that is why you fail. because these guys will not get out of their bubble. They will not get out of this, you know, Fortress Catholicus impregnable bunker that says, well, if I talk to atheists, then I'm going to have to encounter things that I don't like and make me uncomfortable. And so their sole rules for engagement are, you know, get up in the ramparts and yell at atheists to convert or burn.
It's the society of ors as versus a society of both and. That's the big difference between what you were talking about and what Bishop Barron and Pope Francis and Chesterton are talking about.
And the consequence, of course, is that in sacrificing that Fortress Catholicus mentality that thinks that that's the only way to engage the culture, what Bishop Barron did was he moved a lot of people a step closer to the faith and toward the consideration of the possibility that there might actually be something here worth engaging, rather than this sort of cartoonish, you know, fortress idea that they can't be bothered to engage because, you know, who could take it seriously?
Both and creates community or creates clicks. There you go.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, we've come to the end of another show, and alas, we must be on our way. But I want to thank you, Antonetti, for your great contributions today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our producer today was Danny Head. And we will be back tomorrow with Devin Rose. We're going to be talking with Devin Rose about his new book. And so we will see you then. Until then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.